The Green Front with Betsy Rosenberg, Wednesdays at 2 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
By bit, there are signs that we are beginning to wake up and turn things around. Most of that coming from California. Let's hope as California goes, so goes the rest of the country, maybe the world. It seems that way sometimes when we have a governor who gets it. Of course, I'm talking about our current governor, once again, Jerry Brown, the Green governor of this Golden State. And last week we talked about how he had signed legislation banning BPA, that toxic stuff that was showing up in baby bottles and sippy cups. Also word coming late last week that he's also signed legislation that would ban shark fin trade, that of course shark fin soup being the big popular item that is really diminishing severely the world shark population. We're going to have response from the group that was in the forefront of that effort, Wild Aid. Going to say hello to the executive director, Peter Knight, in just a moment, but also want to tell you about the second half of the show. We'll be chatting with Stephen Lacey. He is the other half of the blogosphere on climateprogress.org, my favorite can't-miss daily blog from Joseph Rome and Center for American Progress. Stephen Lacey has not joined us yet, but he writes many of those stories that are just so current, the latest on the scientific and political developments as they're unfolding on the climate scene. That coming up at the bottom of the hour, but first want to celebrate the good news. We have to every time it happens, not often enough, but perhaps we are beginning to see the beginning of the turning of the tide. So welcome to the Green Front, Peter.
Hi, thanks very much.
Tell us about how long this effort has been in the works to ban the trade of and sale of shark fin products here in California, and also the significance of it, because isn't it illegal to do so in this country anyway?
Well, we've been working on the shark fin trade since 1998, and at first we were thinking, you know, well, maybe we just need to reduce demand and it'll be okay. But then, 10 years later on, and we see the demand going through the roof and fishing regulations sort of either not being in place or failing utterly to protect sharks. And so it's got to the point where we feel that, you know, banning is the only way to protect the shark population. So last year, a bunch of groups got together, a really strong coalition of everyone from the Humane Society to some of the hunting and fishing groups, to say, you know, California should no longer be one of the biggest sources of demand for shark fin outside of Asia. And it's been this year working very hard on that. There was some opposition, primarily from San Francisco, and Senator Leyland Yee, who was running for mayor, who decided that he wanted to rabble rouse with this issue and get people stirred up about it. So, but finally, thankfully, on Friday, Jerry Brown signed the bill, and we're very grateful, and puts California where it should be, you know, at the head of environmental legislation around the world.
Now, you said opposition in San Francisco. Usually we're in the forefront of environmental progress, but this, of course, I suspect is a reflection of the large Chinese population in the city.
Well, and also in some elements of very conservative Cantonese Chinese population. Shark fin originated sort of around Hong Kong in southeastern China, and that's where some of the older elements of the Chinese community in San Francisco are from. And so it's very much centered around that. And really, you know, it's been a little bit frustrating because there are very healthier alternatives to shark fin, which can still honor the tradition, if you like. Basically, shark fin soup, the shark fin has absolutely no flavor. And there have been, some alternatives used instead of the shark fin itself. It tastes exactly the same as regular shark fin soup. And in fact, I have one incident where a 92-year-old Chinese lady who'd been eating shark fin soup for 80 years went to one of the restaurants in San Francisco, ate the shark fin soup and said how wonderful it was, and then the chef revealed to her that basically it was not real shark fin soup, it was actually using mung bean paste, and she couldn't tell the difference. So there's an alternative there where people can keep the tradition and not kill the sharks, and that's what we want to see. We're all in favor of maintaining culture and things like that, but you don't need to do it at the cost of the environment.
And what is the cost to the shark population of this delicacy?
Worldwide? Well, it's reckoned that up to 73 million sharks, fins from up to 73 million sharks are used every year in the shark fin industry. And it's been growing and growing. It was originally Hong Kong and Singapore and parts of Taiwan where this was eaten, and not very much in mainland China because, quite simply, people didn't have the money to buy it. And what's happened in the last 10 or 15 years, of course, is, you know, the meteoric rise in China, the economy, which is, you know, very good in terms of bringing people out of poverty and very positive in many ways. But the detrimental effect has been on some wild species that are still used in Chinese cuisine. And sharks have been, you know, decimated by that. And some populations have declined by as much as 98% in the last 15 years. And all over the world, that we've studied this in 12 countries, you know, the fisheries are basically collapsing for those sharks. Sharks reproduce very slowly, and they just simply were never designed by nature to be preyed on very heavily, and human beings have come in as a super predator and just decimated the population.
And should anyone be new to this issue, tell us the devastation that takes place when a fin is taken from a shark. Obviously, it costs a shark's life, but it's a slow and painful and rather messy death at that.
Well, it varies, but just like with, we found, you know, elephant carcasses with just the tusks removed, or rhinos with just the horns cut off, so because the fin is so much more valuable than the flesh in many cases, you know, it might be $100 for the fins and $5 for the meat. So a lot of fishermen around the world, when they fill up, they don't want to fill up their hold with cheap meat, which actually also can damage their other catch. They just want to take the fins. And so in quite a number of cases, the fins are hacked off the shark while it's still alive. We've got footage from Indonesia of a shark with no fins that's been finned alive, sometimes when they're dead, and then the body is just thrown away, and 95% of the animal is completely wasted. And that really is a terrible thing.
It is, especially because it is wasted and lives wasted. And, you know, the ocean is being overfished. We have plastic pollution. We have ocean acidification from climate change. This is yet one more assault. And yet it is something that has captured worldwide attention. So why is it important now, even though California's victory is more than symbolic, because, as you say, it is the second largest population demand for shark fin soup, why do you want to keep the momentum going to really have it go beyond here?
Mm-hmm. Well, there is a lot of momentum now on sharks, thankfully, after a long, long time of a number of organizations and individuals pushing for years and years. The most recent announcement was the Marshall Islands created a shark sanctuary in the Pacific. The Bahamas have banned shark fishing. There's a movement both at the fishing end and at the consumption end. And because it's so hard to control fisheries, especially ones on the open sea, the sales bans are really important, we think, to enable the enforcement of the fishing bans at the same time. So California is probably the largest market outside of Asia, and that's great. And you know, Washington and Oregon have also banned this. Hawaii, American Samoa, Guam. There's a growing movement. And in Canada now, a number of jurisdictions are looking at that as well. But the big kahuna, if you like, the real major source of demand now is in mainland China. And that's really the, if you like, the silver bullet for shark conservation would be a ban on imports of shark fin to China. And that's actually something that has been proposed by members of the National People's Congress in China. Some billionaire businessmen have come out and said, this is something we don't need and we're damaging the world's populations. We need to do something about this. So that's now under review by the Chinese government. And the big, big hope for sharks is that China ends up being a conservation leader for sharks and takes action, because that would help and reinforce every conservation measure around the world for sharks. And, you know, the role of sharks is way beyond just them as a species. They're key predators in most of the ocean's ecosystems. And when you take them out, you kind of shuffle the cards, and nobody knows what's going to come out at the other end. And so it may lead not just to the collapse of shark populations, but also other fish populations and other marine populations.
How important is star power? You had some big fish, pardon the expression, coming out of Hollywood, Leo DiCaprio, Jackson Brown, to really raise awareness about this issue. And you have, as you said, some influential leaders in Shanghai, if not celebrities, then billionaires, who you hope to engage in this effort. It's too bad that that's what it takes, but often that is the case. How important was that in this California effort?
Well, we live in a world of infotainment, I think, and, you know, obviously people like to be entertained, and So if you can engage celebrities and characters like that, to, I think it is more powerful just to get the word out. And by far the most important spokesperson the Sharks have ever had in their lives is Yao Ming, the NBA basketball player, former NBA basketball player. Yao has been the face of this campaign in China. He has incredible integrity, incredible support from across China. As you probably remember, he carried the flag in the Olympics. He's an amazing guy and very nice person, very concerned, very thorough in doing research, and very smart. And he has led the campaign in China, and that has been phenomenal because it has meant there's a Chinese face leading it. He's been very outspoken about it, and that really has had a huge effect. So I think it is very important because what we're trying to do here is change what's socially acceptable. And so I think people do look for leadership in that. They look for people at the cutting edge. And we've been lucky enough in China to have the support of people like Jackie Chan, Yao Ming, Olympic athletes, as well as top businessmen. And this has really been key to getting the message out there that this isn't some sort of foreign conspiracy. This is a legitimate concern about the survival of our planet, and that Chinese people are just as concerned as anybody in the United States about the survival of their planet and the future for their children.
And adding more star power, albeit from an international business point of view, is Sir Richard Branson, who does get a lot of press as well.
Yep, Richard's been fantastic, and he's been very committed to this issue. Actually, we took him earlier this year to swim with whale sharks in Cancun, and he said it was one of the best things he's ever done in his life. And as you know, Richard's had a pretty interesting life, and so he got very inspired by that to take action for it, and he's helped a great deal.
And Ed Norton, of course, and Ted Danson as well, loaning their acting chops and celebrity to that effort. Rosario Dawson as well. James Cameron, he's a big one. He's gotten very involved in the environmental movement since the success of Avatar has put him on the international stage.
Well, and he's long been a fan of the marine environment and back from movies like The Abyss and things like that. And I think, we need to get this out because there's it's quite hard. A lot of environmental news is bad news, but we have to hear it. If we don't hear it, we can't take action. And so I think when celebrities do speak out, it enables bad news to be delivered in a way that if it was just a straight journalist, for example, then people kind of turn off because it's too much doom and gloom. But the reality is we've got to face these problems. And the good news is that hopefully, finally, we are facing the shark situation, and hopefully we can get on top of it and help conserve not just the sharks but other species for future generations.
Another figure worth noting, I think, the support behind Assembly Bill 376, the one that just was signed by Governor Brown. Polling showed that some 76% of all registered voters in California were in favor of a ban, but even more interestingly and revealing is that 70% of, that's 70% of Chinese American voters in the state are also in support of this ban. I think that must have been pretty critical in gaining momentum.
Absolutely. And, you know, I mean, I've worked in Asia for 20 years now, and, you know, we started off doing undercover investigations of what was going on. And what we just found is that people in places like Hong Kong and Taiwan and mainland China care just as much as we might do in the West about these issues, but they didn't know what was going on. And when they have the information, when they know what's happening, they are every bit as sympathetic to environmental concerns as anywhere else in the world. And so I think, you know, that was crucial. That this is, you know, because the opposition always tries to portray it as a cultural issue. And the reality is it's not a cultural issue. It's an environmental issue, and it's an education issue. And when people are educated, they are just as turned off as any Westerners would be.
And we'll talk about for a moment just the positive impacts of using media, in particular movies, you know, to reach, you know, the mainstream American population using movies like The Cove and The Whale, which perhaps you can say a few words about because that's about to make, I believe, its debut at the San Francisco Green Film Festival.
Yeah, I think documentaries are one of the very important tools for sort of raising awareness. We've largely focused on public service announcements with people like Yao Ming and Jackie Chan because you get to repeat them again and again. And the only drawback with a documentary is it can make quite a big furore around when it goes out, but that then tends to fade. And unless there's an ongoing campaign, you know, there may be limited progress is made because it takes an awful lot of effort to change laws and even more effort to change public attitudes, and it does take time. And something like The Cove can have a fantastic impact when it comes out. But if it's not followed up with a campaign, it doesn't have the lasting effect that you're looking for. And I think also, I think it's very important for the film to come from people within the culture, if possible, that you're talking about. And it's kind of difficult to criticize from outside. So you really need, wherever you can, to have, you know, Chinese people speaking to Chinese people, Japanese people speaking to Japanese people, because that has, I think, a lot more force, and you get beyond the instant negative reaction, which is people are attacking us, which you don't want. If you really want to move to a positive outcome where everybody can walk off with dignity, I think, at the end of it.
Mm-hmm. This is the first opportunity I've had to interview you. Very nice to meet you, and I'd love to take this opportunity to learn a little bit more about Wild Aid and what other campaigns mm-hmm. you're working on. I've certainly been aware of your organization, but did not realize you had an office here in the Bay Area. I'm not surprised.
Yep.
A lot of green groups do. So wonderful to meet you on the air and just share with us, you know, what else you're prioritizing this year.
Absolutely. Well, what Wild Aid does, which is kind of unique, is our main focus is reducing the demand for endangered species products. So as well as trying to reduce demand for things like shark fin, we're also working on trying to reduce demand for ivory, which has been a big resurgence in ivory poaching recently, again, partly because of the economic development in China. We're working on rhinos now, rhino horn again. That trade is something which was pretty well suppressed for quite a long time, but it's coming back up again. Tigers are still in very serious trouble. There's less than 3,200 tigers left in the wild, and people are still using their skins and their bones for traditional medicine. We've just been doing some research on manta rays, and manta rays are fairly similar to sharks in that they reproduce very, very slowly. There's very few of them out there, and they're not, generally speaking, subject to prey from other animals. But there is a market that's emerged for the gill rakers of manta rays, which is the sort of the cartilage which holds their gills open. That's being used in a sort of folk remedy now in southern China. So we're looking at that and trying to address that situation. And then the other thing we do is we try and help governments to reinforce marine reserves around the world. So we've done a lot of work in the Galapagos Islands, helping the national park there, which is the size of New York State. It's a massive marine area. And when we started, they had one boat which wasn't functioning to patrol this huge, huge area. Now they have satellite vessels, a monitoring system, which is basically tracks all the boats. They have radar, they have sniffer dogs, and a whole comprehensive system of law enforcement to stop people raiding resources from the marine reserve.
And do you think that the global population is waking up in time to notice, you know, we're having so much change, technological, environmental,
yeah,
political change, such a rapid, can we keep up in terms of just educating the public and organizing people to really pay attention? It seems everyone is so darn busy, and yet these issues are so compelling. I mean, look at what the oceans are facing. If you really take in some of these predictions and made about by the year, 2050, we'll lose, some 70% of major, fish species,
yeah,
the large, fish species population. We almost get a little bit immune to it, I think. We hear it,
yeah,
and then we go back to our seafood dinner, not realizing,
yeah,
what this portends, not just in terms of our enjoyment of, the incredible diversity the ocean, offers up to us in the form of food for humans, but just in terms of what the ocean provides for life on this
mm-hmm.
planet.
Well, it is overwhelming, and the worst thing that people can do is just be completely overwhelmed and give up, which I do think some people do. But I think every one of us has just got to do what we can do. And, certainly the greatest power I always feel we have, once every 4 years, if you're lucky, you get to vote. But you can vote every day with your purchases. What you buy shapes the world we live in. So by eating sustainable seafood, you are, not only not eating unsustainable seafood, but you're encouraging more fisheries to go sustainable. So there's a lot of different things we can do in our daily life, conserving energy, conserving paper and forest resources, buying from renewable sources and things like that. There's a whole load of things we can do. And I think everybody's just got to do what they can within their life. And, that's it. And it's a huge, huge challenge. We need our governments too. It can't just be individual action. And, of course, I think particularly in this country right now, we're going for this kind of stalemate at government, which, while the world is changing faster than it's ever changed before, we have a government in deadlock. And that's not a good recipe, in my opinion, not just for our environment, but also for our economy. you know, I think the challenges are enormous. But then again, human race has met some pretty amazing challenges in the past. And I think, generally speaking, people want the same thing. They want a healthy, safe, clean planet. And, you know, we might have to fight for it. That's the bad news.
Mm. And what about just on the international front? What's happening with, you know, the industrial, you know, overfishing problem, these, you know, mm-hmm. bottom, these trawlers that just scoop up everything in their catch? Is that being addressed, or is that still mostly just something that, you know, people are demanding we pay attention to? What's actually happening out there?
It's very difficult because, you know, the international bodies effectively have no teeth. There is some movement in trying to crack down on illegal fishing internationally. I think, encouragingly, there is some movement to have more marine protected areas. I mean, you know, the backbone of conservation on land has been the national park system around the world, and the marine protected areas are just really in their infancy. Less than 1% of the world is currently protected in any way of our oceans. And, you know, given that nobody actually lives in any of these places, we should be able to, we need to set aside way more parts of the ocean as marine reserves. And I think that's got to be the big push in the next decade, is really to have these no-take areas where fishing stocks can recover. And we actually have a healthy ocean. And this, I see no reason why we can't have 10, 15, 20% of our oceans as protected areas, because those are essentially your bank, which then feeds the rest of the ocean to allow fishing. And what we're doing now is we're just kind of destroying all our capital. All our natural capital is going because we're fishing way too fast and, you know, regulations there.
Remarkable just in terms of our, you know, immunity to it, it seems, just as a culture, mm-hmm. at least here in America. It's
pretty much worldwide.
So
I mean, you know, the fisheries of Europe, which have been managed in inverted commas longer than anywhere else in the world, are a disaster right now because, you know, they've just been overfished, because ultimately what happens usually is politics trump science. So the scientists are saying we need to stop, we need to lower the quotas, and the fishing lobby is pushing hard, and, you know, the politicians give way usually. And it's kind of weird because it is very often an industry that's committing suicide. But it makes sense in the short-term economics for them to do that and then move on to something else or another place. So the European fisheries have now moved down into West Africa and are taking the West African fish. So it's very sad, but it's a big problem.
As if, you know, we're the last generation, or maybe our kids will be. You know, it's unthinkable what we're leaving behind or not for, you know, future generations. And the short-sightedness is surely going to come back to haunt us. And yet this is a moment right now where we should all be waking up and taking action and, you know, really acknowledging the planetary crises. How concerned are you about ocean acidification? That could be something extremely serious if we're seeing, you know, a degree or two change in temperature affecting shellfish and other, you know, coral reefs and other marine life.
Ways
we don't even know. We can't fathom, again, pardon the pun, but the depth.
No, it's nightmarish. As the father of two small children, I mean, we're the first human generation that has had the knowledge and, I think, the money to be able to fix these problems, and we're not doing it because we'd rather plow on. You know, it's sort of like the drunken sailor on the binge, and, you know, our children are going to get the hangover. And I mean, mm-hmm. to make matters worse, it's not just the situation we have now. We're going to have a situation with billions more people on the planet, the people per capita consuming way more than they did, and the growth of both population and also consumption has been almost exponential since the 1950s, and we don't seem to be having any real strategies to deal with that or slow it down. So I think, you know, we're leaving our children an awful lot of messes to deal with, and I think it's very cowardly of us, frankly. But ocean acidification is a major, major problem. I mean, altering the fundamental building blocks of marine life, which ultimately control the oxygen content in the planet. What people really don't know and can only begin to guess at is the kind of compounding effect when some of these things interact with each other, with climate change and ocean acidification, pollution, all these things interact, and there could really be some horrendous catastrophes out there. And, you know, we really are just carrying on like it's all fine, just as we are in things like Social Security. So it seems to be the way we're operating right now.
Yes, and my particular area of passion and focus is green media, or lack thereof. You know, we have how many channels dedicated to sports and business, and how many, a plethora of reality shows that have nothing to do with actual reality. But I don't know if you've noticed, but there's actually not one program on mainstream radio or television, that deals with our ecological crises and not only the challenges but the solutions that, you know, mm-hmm. abound for how to at least begin to address them, maybe that's part of the problem. And yet we have programs and, yeah. you know, talk show hosts who are very, yeah. very quick to dismiss any such concern about climate change, ocean depletion, or, you know, species disappearing, in fact, mocking those of us who were trying to call attention to it, you know, just a bunch of tree huggers. And that's well-funded, and they're getting away with it. And that, to me, after 15 years of trying to get a foothold in mainstream media with this kind of conversation, with these, you know, kinds of interviews and subject matters with experts like yourself and, you know, so many people out there working so hard, they don't have a platform. They don't have a forum. Online, maybe, but that's not where the mainstream is listening, and they're not going to seek out these programs. So any commentary on that as we wrap up in the last few minutes?
Well, I mean, I think it's not just environment, but certainly, you know, in Europe, there are a lot more environmental journalists that actually that's what they do. They do environment here. People pick up the beat when they have the chance. And very little gets reported. Even major environmental news stories kind of get buried. And I think, and beyond that, it's the, you know, the balance has been interpreted to mean if there are two different opinions, even if there's 100 on one side and one on the other, you give mm-hmm. them equal time, which is not balanced at all, and it's not fair at all. But that's how it's been interpreted. And so,
not serving
even
us.
The sharp
not
industry,
serving us.
You know, we got this thing where it said there's like major opposition, and you look at it, it's like, but actually, it's only 18% of the Chinese community. So it's a very small minority overall, and Californians are opposed to this, and yet it was made like it was a 50-50 argument. So I think the media is very much to blame with that, and I think I enjoy reading the English newspapers because there they just, you know, they're much more sort of the journalists take a position based on the weight of evidence, which is, I think, what a journalist should be bound to do. And we seem to have lost that over here somehow.
Are you thinking about going back to Great Britain because you're disillusioned with what's going on here? I wish I had another country to move to of origin. It's really discouraging to be an American right now. Hard to be proud.
Yeah. Well, it's worrying as a father of two American kids and an American wife. It's just kind of, you know, we just seem to be plunging. And as I say, I'm originally an economist, but my concerns are for the economy of the United States and for jobs, and we seem to be missing the opportunities, which, frankly, being environmentally friendly creates jobs. It creates local jobs. And somehow it's got spun the other way, that if you have the environment, you're destroying jobs. And that's certainly not the case in my experience that I've seen. And, you know, that is a very backward-looking way. In a world that's changing ever faster, and I'd spent a lot of time working in China, boy, the Chinese are planning ahead. They're investing in solar. They're going to leave us behind in this race. And that's very concerning as a parent.
Once again, we'll be importing, you know, consumer goods, not just computers, and you know, cotton clothing, cheap cotton clothing from China, but solar panels and clean technology as well, if we keep
Absolutely. This
up. Well, I hope to have a woman named Rebecca Costa, who just wrote a fabulous book called Watchman's Rattle, all about why we're being so slow to change, in particular to the ecological crises we're facing. Apparently, we've just not had to evolve this quickly before, and yet if we don't, we certainly will not be around to talk about it in centuries to come at the rate we're going. But let's hope it doesn't come to that, and I certainly want you to stay here. We need experts and activists like you, Peter Knight, Executive Director with Wild Aid. Thank you for all the work you're doing personally, also the work that Wild Aid is doing. And just so we can wrap up on a positive note, just want to reiterate the positive news that we started out talking about. There's just so much work to do beyond this. But Governor Jerry Brown last week did sign legislation, AB 376, into law that would ban the import, possession, and sale of shark fins in the state of California. And since we are one of the largest markets for shark fins outside of Asia, that is significant. Let's hope that it grows from here. And thanks for taking the time to be with us, and good luck in your other campaigns.
Thank you very much.
That is Peter Knight. When we come back, we're going to be speaking with Stephen Lacey. He is a blogger at climateprogress.org. We're going to be talking about the state of the solar industry, the good news behind all the Solyndra controversy and non-controversy, the bogus controversy that has caused, what it means, what it doesn't mean, and we'll try to find some positive bits in there as well. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Green Front. I'm Betsy Rosenberg.